Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 355 for November 11th of 2016. Buckle up. President Trump is about to take the auto industry on a wild ride. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, welcome everybody to another episode of AutoLine After Hours. My co-host, Gary Vasilash, my co-pilot, is not here today. He's out towards, I think he might be at the L.A. show or heading out that way. And Chrysler's got a big program going for the media with the Pacifica. But joining us in the studio today, we've got Todd Lasa from Automobile Magazine. Todd, always good to have you here.
Always good to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
We also have Chris Pockert from Roadshow by CNET.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Cool. And Mike Whalen from the Detroit News.
John,
good to have you too, Mike.
Always fun.
So there's never any shortage of things to talk about, but this is the week that Donald Trump done got himself elected as the next president of the United States. And I think this is going to have huge implications for the automotive industry based on some of the things he talked about on the campaign trail. What do you guys, Mike, why don't we start with you? What's your first reaction?
I might have heard that he was elected, I thought. I thought I might have heard that earlier this week. And, yeah, we actually just kind of looked into it a lot from the auto side of things. And if he keeps maybe even half or a quarter of his promises regarding trade, regarding building a wall, and just a few other factors about the government not getting involved as much, we are going to have a profound change in the auto industry. And we haven't seen it in the stock price as much as a lot of people thought we were going to see it. Because yesterday, I think Fiat Chrysler and GM were down 4%. And then Ford was actually even, and they've been about level today, if not up. But because of the insecurity and the unknown right now, consumer confidence, everyone's saying, is going to be down. And when that's down, people don't buy cars. So in the short term, people are wondering if we're going to maybe start slipping into another bit of a decline for auto sales, and it'd be the fourth month in a row if we are down this much, which would be the first time that would to occur since the beginning of the Great Recession in 2007.
I don't buy the fact that car sales are down, but let's stick to the we'll come back to that later. Let's stick with the election.
Well, I kind of want to defend the idea that car sales are down. Actually, they've leveled off so far, but just had Toyota and Nissan revising downward their expectations for their fiscal years, which end not at the end of this year, but in March of 2017. Toyota expects to sell 60,000 units fewer than its original projection. I'm not sure where that was. I think the original projection was more or less flat from last year, which was a record year. And now it's saying, well, 60,000 fewer, and they sold about 1.5 million in the U.S. last year. So not a huge number, but a significant number. So, yeah, I think there's going to be some uncertainty. There may have been some uncertainty no matter which candidate was elected, whether it was Hillary Clinton or Donald J. Trump. But I think even more uncertainty. The interesting thing I see is that Trump was not with the standard Republican Party line on one thing all his campaign, and that was on free trade. The Republicans are generally big on free trade. You know, he excoriated Ford for moving production down in Mexico, even though Ford kept saying, no, we're going to put other product in the Michigan plant that is shifting small cars down to Mexico. So that's the one thing where he doesn't fit in with the Republican Party standard, where he does fit in, and this has only happened, I think, in the last couple of days since his upset election, is that he is making all kinds of noise about how he's just going to take off the shackles of regulation on all kinds of industries, some of which may not make any difference at all, including in the auto industry, because we already have automakers doing radical things to meet the 2025 CAFE standards. Now, we talked about this, that, you know, if he says, especially in this midterm review, it comes out that they don't need to meet those 2025 CAFE, that'll put some relief on them. But they've already got the designs, the engineering in place to try to meet that.
They already have a lot of the sunk costs factored in. I think that's fair. It'll be interesting to see once he takes office and once he builds his cabinet, what kind of information and advice he gets and how much he actually processes that, because he's obviously made a lot of big claims. You know, he wants to walk away from NAFTA. He actually has the power to do that. I think he can announce that we are exiting NAFTA and give a six-month
lead
time
to get into that. Because this is a treaty with two other countries. That's got to be settled in the Senate. I don't think the president can arbitrarily just say, hey, we're not abiding by this any longer.
My understanding of what I've read is that he has to give 6 months' notice and that he has the power to leave NAFTA.
Well, and with the tariffs that he's been talking about, too, anywhere from 10% to 35% on imported automobiles coming from Mexico, or 45% coming from China, which GM probably wouldn't like too much with the Envision. But that has to be approved, and he cannot just levy those on the different countries. And NAFTA, it's not just NAFTA either. I mean, Mexico has so many different treaties and free trade agreements with different countries. The automakers could get around it somehow, even if they were to walk away from NAFTA or slap a heavy tariff on that. That's what a lot of the analysts are doing, are saying. And they're also saying that they think Trump might even back down a little bit because he made a lot of claims. He's going to build a wall for Mexico for immigration. He's going to get rid of the regulations. He's going to slap this tariff on Mexico. You can't really do all of that immediately. He's going to have priorities. And like you said, people are waiting to see his cabinet and waiting to see what he's actually going to do first. If he aims on trade first, we're going to see a lot of change, I think, in the next year. If he doesn't, though, when he goes for immigration first or different other regulations or even unemployment or jobs or anything like that, I mean, it might fall through the cracks a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And there's likely to be some negatives and some positives from the perspective of, you know, the auto executives. The trade situation with Mexico, I think, would give any of them reason for pause if they've got plants down there. But the deregulation, potentially, the emissions and crash test standards and all of those things, on some level, you know, really could help automakers recover costs a little bit, or, you know, skimp out on some engineering or push things further downfield. Whether or not that's in line with their global product portfolio, when, you know, the U.S. will pull back, but they still have to engineer cars for other countries that are, you know, to higher standards, you know, that'll be an interesting thing.
I don't see the automakers stopping right now. They're going to $24 billion in Mexico since 2010, according to the Center for Automotive Research. They already have a footprint there. You've got the Detroit automakers announcing different cars that are going to be built down there, including Fiat Chrysler with the Jeep Compass. Huge product, small SUV, crossover, whatever you'd like to call it, coming into the U.S. in that very important market. And they're not going to slow down yet. I think maybe eventually in their product plans for the next 2 to 5 years after that, where they haven't had it set yet, they might be holding back a little bit. But I think for the current time right now, I mean, they have their investment there, they have their product plan, and just because he was elected, that's not going to change right now.
Well, and on the one hand, you have what automakers are doing is they're figuring out that put their low-margin vehicles in places like Mexico where you have low costs, low labor costs, and so on, and then still continue to build the better, the higher margin vehicles, you know, the bigger Jeeps, the CUVs instead of sedans. In the case of Ford, they're moving the Focus down to Mexico, and then they'll build the Ranger replacement and the new Bronco up here in Michigan, the Michigan assembly plant. And so that's what's happening in the industry worldwide. I mean, Volkswagen's doing the same thing, where they're building their luxury cars in Germany, but they're building Volkswagens and Skodas in the old
Eastern Europe
and the old Soviet bloc. And meanwhile, while all that's going on, the kind of reaction, I think, because of blue-collar workers everywhere and their clout through unions with their governments, is that you're seeing, you know, what Trump might do with NAFTA is not that different than you look at Brexit and you think about how automakers there, will they continue to build Vauxhalls and Hondas and Nissan, I think, is over there building cars, or will they have to move out of the UK because of Brexit? And you have, you know, this other kind of nationalistic politics happening in various parts of the world, including Germany, including France.
Yeah, look, I mean, getting back to NAFTA and especially vis-a-vis Mexico, I think Trump is delusional if he thinks he's going to bring all kinds of manufacturing jobs back to the
exactly.
United States.
Exactly. It doesn't mean just because you get rid of NAFTA that they're all going to come back.
Right. Look, you know, we've seen a 50-year decline in manufacturing jobs in the automotive industry. Why? Mainly because of automation, robotics, and technological advantages, lean manufacturing. That's not going to change at all. And besides, right now, none of the domestic automakers, GM, Ford, or FCA, have any excess capacity. So if you want to bring product back from Mexico, that means building new plants. And what are you going to be bringing back? What you guys were just talking about. The low-volume passenger car or low-priced passenger cars that nobody, I shouldn't say nobody's buying, but sales are in a downward trajectory there, too. So, and one last thought on it is Mexico is a great supply of low-cost components, parts and components for cars that are assembled in the United States and Canada, for that matter. You chop that off, and all of a sudden, the U.S. is no longer cost competitive to export vehicles elsewhere in the world. Mexico is what makes NAFTA, the NAFTA region, competitive against China. Mexico is what makes NAFTA a more attractive place to make cars than the EU. So I think, you know, you slam the door on Mexico and you will hurt the American automotive industry.
And I'd like to believe that if he's half the businessman he claimed to be throughout the election process, that he'll look at the numbers, he'll get the advice and see, oh, well, there's a reason why vehicles are made abroad. And there's a, if you look at the sales of certain brands, they're more in China
okay,
or more
so
abroad.
So let's say he does. So let's say he's persuaded by the facts, and I'm not sure he will be.
Nor
what,
I.
How does he spin that? Because, I mean, he got elected because people believe he's going to deliver on this. He can't just all of a sudden go, hey, you know, hey, guess what, people? I looked at the facts and we can't do, and he's not going to do that. He's got to spin it somehow.
He can be a politician. He can promise a bunch of things during campaigning and then not follow through on them.
Well, and he's promising to do a lot of things on his first day, and that's part of it.
If you think liberals don't like him, you wait until he spurns the people who put him in office. There'll be
He could turn out to be a traditional politician. His acceptance speech was very political and not like what we saw during the campaigning. So, I mean, he could change it. One thing people have, analysts, economists have been telling me, TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, DOA. It's just dead in the water now because it was on shaky ground before. And now with, and it's funny because the Democrats brought in the TPP and they brought in NAFTA, while the Republicans are usually the ones that support it.
Right.
But, yeah, the TPP, I think, is sunk.
Wow.
And well, but he's made a number of promises. So it kind of depends on where is this in his list of priorities.
Yes.
And for example, you have, you know, he made promises to the coal industry, to coal workers in West Virginia, and coal is losing out. It is more than the climate control.
It's the cost.
It's
natural
the cost versus
cheaper.
Natural gas.
Right.
Exactly. So. I mean, if you're talking about bringing back industries that are dying on their own, how are you going to do that? And where and you could say it's a dying industry to build cars in the country of origin. That, as I said, you want to have your low margin vehicles built in the cheaper countries to produce, and you have to do that because China and not the U.S. is now the world's largest market for cars.
That's right. Although, if you look at NAFTA, NAFTA's awfully close to China.
Awfully close, but how long ago was it before we said China's almost caught up with the U.S.?
Right.
Not that long ago,
no,
right?
No, absolutely.
There'll
true.
Be some daylight happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even that country is reaching its maturity in terms of market penetration for automobiles. So now you've got Ford looking at India big time, for example. So, you know, you have to look at other countries.
Well, and one of Trump's, you mentioned the blue collar and the workers. 1 in 3 UAW members support Trump. I think that's the latest from the UAW. It was 1 in 4. It's been fluctuating.
That's what the UAW is saying.
Yes.
I think the number's higher.
You think?
Because, we had Dennis Williams in from the UAW here for the TV show before the election. And he was admitting that one in four, 25% supported Trump of his members. Now you're saying it's 30%.
I just saw a tweet before we walked in. I believe it was 32%, so almost one in three supported. And that was their numbers. But Trump's one of the biggest things he came out and told the Detroit News when he first started campaigning, really, for automotive, was one of the ways to cut costs would be to move the plants away from the United States, essentially, to the South. And that's what really kind of grinded Dennis Williams' gears to make him completely say, we do not support Trump, even before the membership data came in.
Yeah. But if you look at Macomb County, you know, which everybody identified back in 1980 because Ronald Reagan swept it, and it's the first time a Republican had taken a solidly working-class Democratic county, they went heavily in favor of Trump. So that suggests to me there's more than 30% UAW workers who voted for Trump. I think the support was far higher.
They certainly made the difference in Michigan, going for Trump instead of for Clinton, no question. And that combined with a lower turnout in Detroit versus 2008 and 2012. There's one other issue we may or may not be thinking about regarding the Trump presidency, and that's one of his biggest priorities, of course, is immigration, controlling immigration. And I don't know what the statistics are, I mean, new immigrants to this country drive the auto industry to a pretty good extent. People come to this country and they buy cars, and they often come from a place where they because of the economics of the country couldn't afford it, or because, you know, you were in a place where you didn't have to have a car, and now unless you immigrate to New York City or San Francisco, you're going to need a car. And if you buy a used one, you're buying it from someone who's maybe trading in for a new one anyway. So what effect could that have on demand for the automobile, since we were talking about...
Interesting thought.
Well, he's not against immigration. He's just against illegal immigration. And probably the illegals running across the Rio Grande aren't going out and buying cars.
Well, how much restriction will he put on immigration from predominantly Muslim countries?
Yeah, he might do that.
That's a whole separate issue.
I mean, he's made it pretty clear he's not against immigration. He's just against illegal immigration.
It's a separate issue, but the point is those are people who buy cars.
But his comments about Muslims, though, in general, about not allowing any of them in and doing different things like that, that, to Todd's point, I think, isn't just about illegal immigration. That's just immigration overall and not allowing certain people into the country.
Unless they want to clean the bedrooms at Mar-a-Lago, right? You know, then they're more than welcome.
And frankly, if it's a more hostile climate for immigration to happen to begin with, whether it's factual, you know, in terms of procedure, or it's just perception, people will maybe look somewhere else other than the United States to come to move to.
Right.
And that could
Canada's
have an effect as well.
Pretty good for a lot of people these days. not just some Americans, but other countries.
Well, what about the regulations then, too? What happens to the midterm review? Does this change the midterm review, of course, being... the car companies and EPA all debating on whether they should keep the current fuel economy standards in place, or if they should back off or tighten them up, or what?
You know, I was at a Continental had a few journalists for lunch a couple of days ago, and we're talking about the 48 volt systems that will be kind of a stepping stone to full EVs not being ready until, in a large way, until 2030. And I know that sounds funny, since we know the numbers for electrified vehicle penetration from another event three of us were just at is barely 2.9% in the U.S. But because of CAFE, again, this gets back to what we were saying before, because of CAFE, all the automakers are already going heavily into electrification, 48-volt, higher efficiency engines, whether they're in big trucks or small cars, they have to meet those standards. They've had to work on meeting those standards for many years, leading up to 2025, 54.5 MPG. If somehow the Trump administration relaxes that, either gives it more time or just says, you know, takes the extreme angle and says, you don't need to meet this, to hell with CAFE, which... The early indications are that Trump wants to do that. for all kinds of regulations. Well, the automakers are going to go forth with that anyway.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, it's a state's rights issue as well. You know, California is driving all of that. And the, you know, the group of states that have aligned with their standards. And you would think, based on, you know, other policy proclamations, that Trump would be aligned with the idea of states' rights versus central government and regulation. And California is going to continue to want to do what they want to do. They may come to loggerheads about it, but I think there's enough sales in that block of states that the automakers are still going to probably have to drive toward that standard if California is still allowed to keep it.
Well, and right before we got in here, the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers, which represents the 12 pretty much largest automakers in the U.S., sent their recommendations to President-elect Trump and his kind of transition committee, and they did mention those standards, and they wanted more uniform standards with all the states, not just California, and they were saying that the incentives weren't there in the other states for the people of those states to actually buy the vehicles. And a few other things that they said, they wanted more standardized things across the government, and they mentioned CAFE and fuel economy and CO2 emissions. They didn't say we don't want them. They just kind of said let's have consistent and coherent regulations, not rather let's just cut them.
Yeah, I don't know what Trump would be able to do about California, because the reason California is in a special situation is it started to implement the first automotive emission standards before the federal government did. Mm-hmm. I want to say they started in like, I should look it up, but it was like California started in 1966 and the federal government started in 1968, a couple of years
later.
That's
about right. 67 was, well, yeah, you're right, I think.
But anyway, California got there first, and because of that, and this was a Supreme Court case. The state was sued over this to say, no, you can't do this. And the Supreme Court decided, no, you guys started before the federal government did. You guys in California did. So you can write whatever emission standards you want. You're legal to do that. Then it became an issue of additional states, mainly in the northeast of the U.S.
And 10 of them, yeah.
We want California standards. And I believe it was another court case that went to the Supreme Court that said, yes, they cannot enact their own regulations, but they can adopt those of California. So to your point, Chris, I think this could come down to a big states' rights argument and maybe go all the way to the Supreme Court. But, yeah, what do you do if you're a Republican who has traditionally been a states' rights advocate and now California is doing something that you don't advocate for?
And then on the other hand, you know, if you've got so much on your plate as president or as the Trump administration, why do you bother with such minutia if, as we've all noted, the automakers are trying to meet at least the federal 2025 CAFE standards and obviously, you know, the California, the CARB standard and the 10 states agreeing with it is what has driven what little there is of an EV market in this country anyway. It's all East and West Coast, and because of that California mandate.
And the automakers are still profitable even while they're sinking all these dollars for R&D and production into these very small volume vehicles. Yeah. And I think if you look at that and say they're healthy, I mean, I know, you know, we're looking at not the record peak that we were, the market, and maybe a little moderation in that regard. But nobody's, at least as far as I've seen right now, predicting, you know, the bottom falling out of the market and profits going away.
So. I was
going
to say they're profitable right now, though, at record sales. And since the downturn, I mean, we've just had sales increasing. The big test is going to be when they plateau, like they possibly are going to right now. Not at 16.5, 17 million vehicles. Yeah, let's just keep that. That's fine. For this year, last year, and even maybe even 2018, which is really weird to say. But it's if those sales start going downward, and we've seen incentives going up, but the ATPs are also going up, so it's kind of one hand washes the other.
Yeah. Well, hold on. We got to take a quick break right now. We're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear. Okay, we'll do that, and we got a whole lot more to talk about coming up right after this.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location,
driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. Todd, I had to cut you off. Do you remember what your question was about?
I was going to say, actually, it's not a question, but to Mike's point, you know, it really comes down to trucks again, because we know that the big three, or Detroit three as we call them now, GM and Ford and Fiat Chrysler, are working hard on next few years. We're going to see a new trucks from Fiat Chrysler and from GM that will be designed to meet that 2025 standard. Ford's already taken its shot with aluminum, and I think we know from the last quarter earnings, for example, that as big as the profit margins are on any full-size body-on-frame truck, Ford has taken a bit of a hit with that cost of aluminum. But they're going forward. We're going to have that no matter what, the Trump administration does. And you look at it and say, well, first of all, those trucks will still be providing the majority of profits to the Detroit automakers. Secondly, you know, nobody talks about gas prices. There just doesn't seem to be any way for OPEC or for any other oil producers to get the price of gasoline on up. There's just too much supply. Sooner or later, it could happen. And if you're selling a truck that now gets, say, 25 or 30 MPG instead of 15 or 18, you're not in a bad place necessarily. So again, the kind of forces that have forced the automakers to push for much more efficient pickup trucks will pay off for them somewhere down the line.
Hey, somebody watching the show, guest 136, was listening to us, and he says, won't the California Air Resources Board become the new de facto regulator for the car industry?
In some ways, it already has.
Well, in many ways. Yeah. In many ways.
Yeah. Would it become more so under, let's say, and I don't think it's going to happen, but let's say a President Trump guts the EPA and scraps CAFE.
No way to touch CARB? Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, he reportedly, one of his top, if not his appointment for the head of the EPA, is going to be a climate skeptic, a very well-known climate skeptic. So, I mean, everything's on the table right now. And no one can tell in this election cycle. That's what an analyst told me. He goes, everything is on the table right here.
Yeah. This could become a really huge fight if indeed he sees a way to try to force California out of it. The whole question of states' rights, because California, as we know, was blue in this week's election, and will, as were several of the 10 states on the East Coast that also voted for Clinton.
Yeah. So. Okay, Barry wants to know, if President Trump relaxes EPA regulations or the schedule, why would that limit our global competitiveness? Aren't the global automakers the ones whose responsibility it is to be competitive?
You know, even if we lessen our standards, the automakers are still competing globally, and Europe has very high standards now as well. So, I mean, the automakers aren't just going to take their foot off the pedal. Well, yeah. I guess they are taking their foot off the pedal for better efficiency, but they're just not going to stop investing in fuel-efficient technologies, and they're already in place right now for 2022, let's say.
It might save some V8 engines for the North American market, but again, if you're selling a Ford Focus or a General Motors Compact, that's an Opel Vauxhall Chevrolet CUV, because that's what all anybody cares about now, not the compact cars. you're not gonna. It's cheaper to build a couple of engines that serve the entire global market. Rather than say, oh, hey, now we can go pollute all we want, so let's do a new engine for North America. That's where the competitiveness comes in, is that, you know, you're still competing with Volkswagen and Toyota and other companies that will be offering.
One manner in which it could change things, though, we already see automakers develop a much broader engine portfolio for other countries. You go to Europe and you've got your choice of, you know, in a given model, three or four diesels and a couple of gas engines. If some of the hurdles are taken out of that certification process, you could end up with more powertrain diversity here in the States.
They are becoming more standardized, though. I mean, say from 10 years ago before the downturn, because downsizing and turbocharging, I mean, Europe, yeah, really popular, and then Ford brought it over here. I think they're the biggest leader in that right now. So you are seeing more standardization with those small displacement engines to the U.S., to other markets.
Yeah, here's how I see it hurting U.S. the competitiveness of the U.S. industry if you do away with CAFE. This industry, and I'm just building on what you guys said because I totally agree with it. This industry is all about scale. You know, unless you make 10 million cars, or certainly over 6 million to 10 million vehicles a year is the sweet spot for any automaker right now. If all of a sudden you say, okay, the vehicles we sell in the United States, they don't have to meet global competitive standards. Okay, you just took a huge chunk of your scale out of your equation. You've driven up your costs across the board, both in the U.S. and for what you're trying to sell overseas. So, yeah, taking the U.S. Away from what the rest of the world is doing, I think, would absolutely hurt the competitiveness of the U.S. industry, just because of the scale.
And the automakers aren't necessarily against CAFE. They supported it. I mean, when it first came out, I'm sure they'd maybe like a few more years for it to take hold. And Marchionne, he's kind of a interesting fellow to talk with about that, but they're not outright against the CAFE standards completely.
No, they're not. In fact, I think they would argue to keep them in place. To your point, I think they'd say, look, don't make the goal in 2025, make the goal in 2030, and now we're good with that. It gives us a whole nother design cycle to get on board with that.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. We've got even more questions here. Which one should I go with? Well, here's one that gets us off some of the stuff we've been talking about. What are your thoughts? This is from Mac Murphy via Twitter. What are your thoughts on Ford bringing the EcoSport to America? And he wants to know, too. We know two new products are coming into the Michigan assembly plant. Mm-hmm. Is that one of them? And is the Ranger
no.
the other?
No. The Ranger and the Bronco. The much rumored, I should say, Bronco, which will be based on the Ranger. And this is something of a retro vehicle, but a small sport utility that fits yet another niche and has that nostalgia, and it's a cool product, and we'll share a lot of parts with the Ranger. The EcoSport would be a unibody vehicle, whereas the Ranger and presumably the Bronco.
So this
would
is the EcoSport up on the screen?
Yeah.
And that's the Bronco.
That's an alleged Bronco.
Yeah, that's an alleged
Nobody
Bronco.
Nobody has seen the Bronco. We don't know if it'll be even more retro than this or if this is a fair representation. I don't know where that rendering came from.
It's not going to be retro. They're going to do what they do and make it more fuel efficient. It's going to have that smoother body. And the EcoSport has that smoother body. I saw a few of them driving around Dearborn. And regarding where it's going to be built, I actually just had this discussion on Twitter with John Stoll and a few other journalists. We really think Mexico. That's where they build the focus for the U.S. market. Currently, the EcoSport, Eco.
That's a Brazilian truck, isn't it?
Brazilian, and they've got two main production locations, and then two joint ventures, I believe, for the EcoSport, and Brazil and India.
Are they on their second?
Here's the EcoSport. And we should explain that Ford will pronounce it EcoBoost when it comes to the turbo engine, but when it comes to this vehicle, they call it EcoSport.
Do they really?
Okay, I actually was wrong in that. Okay, I've been calling it EcoSport.
And it's because overseas people pronounce it Echo, not Eco. Eco is a very American pronunciation. So you watch. Ford's going to market it as the EcoSport. I wonder if that name will stick.
Not if it raises images of the old Toyota Echo. The EcoSport, EcoSport, whatever you want to call it. Remember, this is a B-segment CUV. So this is a space where Ford isn't currently. It's smaller.
It's a gaping hole in their line in the U.S.
smaller than the Escape. Yes. Well, this is an emerging segment. I guess the Buick Encore would have been the first one in this segment. Right. Now you've got the Mazda CX-3, you've got the Chevy Trax, you've got
Renegade,
the Honda
500.
Renegade.
It's the hottest segment in the industry.
And we've talked about this before. The anecdotal evidence seems to be that people are trading in mid-sized sedans for compact sport utilities, crosser utilities. They're trading in compact sedans for subcompact crossover utilities. They're basically going up instead of out.
And that's a transaction change that all automakers seem to support because they can charge more for these compact crossovers than they can for the equivalent sedan or hatchback.
So better margin, but still in that segment, not as good a margin as a Bronco or Ranger.
Well, and the current Echo Sport is on the B, Global B platform, I believe, which is shared with the Focus, which is built...
No, Fiesta is B.
B. Yeah. Okay.
B
but built in Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah. Which
it would
is
just
where Fiesta is built.
Make,
yeah, right.
Get that truck in or get that small utility in there, start building it, and get to the market as soon as possible.
Are they going to put it in Mexico? Why wouldn't you just bring them in from Brazil? I mean, Brazil's, you know, the market.
Well, as long as you've got NAFTA, that might be better
to
bring it in.
I mean, this is all skepticism from us. So Ford, obviously, as I mentioned, they haven't even confirmed the Ranger or the Bronco, has reported. Yeah. But that was just us kind of throwing things back and forth that because they have those facilities down there that have that platform, why not?
Yeah. You know, what I want to know is what they do to the new Echo Sport. Because, remember, they took it to Europe. They exported it from Brazil to Europe. It was a flop.
The first generation
didn't work.
Bomb. Yeah, well, and then they pulled it, right?
It was the second generation, if I recall correctly.
The first was in 2003, I believe. And then the second was 2011 or 2013.
Yeah, I think it started in Brazil sooner. Yeah, it might have been 2011 in Brazil. But, you know, they had the spare tire on the outside, you know, fifth door. And I know Europeans did not like that at all. They didn't like it hanging out there.
Well, it certainly doesn't do wonders for crash costs. You know, if you look at the repair costs, having that spare tire carrier out there, that's what hits in large measure before bumpers do. So they, you know, you remember a few years ago when they started doing the pull test in crash testing, anything with a rear, you know, spare tire carrier just bombed those tests.
Plus, it makes subcompact CUV as parkable as a compact.
Right. They're
just adding length.
But you notice that photograph, it did have the exterior spare. So I think you'll see that go away. I think you'll see, you know, significantly higher contenting inside. Obviously, you know, maybe a more robust powertrain, but you'll probably see nicer materials. You'll probably see a lot more NVH materials inside. I'd have to look at the sales numbers, but I don't think that this generation has done what they kind of hoped that it would globally, and so it'll be interesting to see what happens when they bring it here.
Yeah. You think they'd put the 1-liter EcoBoost in there, the 3-cylinder?
They might. You know, that was always an MPG play, right?
Yeah, right.
And you go down the street here, the gas stations that we've got locally are selling gas for $1.99 a gallon.
Well, and sold in this country only with a manual, so maybe I've just answered my own question.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Hey, look, we got to take another quick break right now. We're just going to do a promo. We'll be back. We got a lot more to talk about here.
From Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
This is Focus.
Okay.
I mean, Escape.
Oh, okay.
Okay, we're back. Hey, we got a couple of phone calls that have come in. We got to get to those. Carmen, let's bring in the first one.
Hey, guys. Jonathan Brown. Great show, as always.
Jonathan.
Listen, tell me why America should allow Chinese-built automobiles to be sold in the United States without the same restrictions that China put on American manufacturers to sell goods in China. If we don't force fair trade with China, then we will surely lose the automobile industry in the United States. We need to have the same laws and rules that China imposes on American manufacturers, and I mean all of them, that China imposes on our companies as we work to sell products in China. Explain to me why not.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jonathan. Okay. Go. I see Mike chomping at the bit to jump in on
this. Yeah, we've got an answer.
There are no Chinese automakers selling vehicles in the United States right now.
Right.
There are American automaker, more will likely be coming, GM, importing vehicles from China
and
to
Volvo.
The U.S.
And Volvo.
So,
are
they doing it as well?
Yeah.
So
already?
Yeah, S60 long wheelbase.
Oh, right, of course.
And they just announced the new
F90
is coming from China, too.
Well, so That is different than the U.S. going there, building cars there, and selling the cars there, which is when they have to do the joint ventures partner compared to we're going to see a Chinese-built car from a Chinese automaker in the U.S. in the next,
and probably Guangzhou. Geely just announced a new sub-brand, middle brand between Volvo and Geely called Lynxon Company, kind of a funny name, but they may be one of the first. But the other answer is numbers. I mean, yes, we have to do GM, Ford, FCA, any foreign automaker has to find a local joint venture, which is usually a government-run company in China, to do 50-50 ownership of the plant and output and so on. But, you know, Buick now claims to sell more than 1 million cars a year globally. Well, most of those are in China. That's been a huge a boon for General Motors, especially. Chrysler had some success many years ago because of a Jeep Beijing plant, and everybody wants to be there. Ford is trying to save the Lincoln brand mostly by selling it in China, by pulling a Buick, basically.
But I got to tell you, I'm with Jonathan on this one, because that was my argument all the way back, if you go back into the early 80s, when the Japanese were just cleaning house here. And the Reagan administration implemented what they called the Voluntary Restraint Agreement, where all the Japanese car companies agreed to restrain themselves from selling as many cars as they could in America. And my take all the time was, why don't we just take Japan's trade restrictions and adopt them? And that's exactly what Trump has talked about on the campaign trail, of dealing with countries saying, look, we're just going to adopt your standards, your trade standards, and we're going to implement them. So if you look right now, if a car is made in China and exported to the United States, it pays a 2.5% import tariff. If you make a car in the United States and sell it in China, it's hit with a 25% tariff. And in fact, if you go back to the bailout in 2009, China said, oh, you're bailing out your car companies. So any car that's made in the United States, and it doesn't have to be a big three vehicle, this goes equally well to Mercedes and BMW exporting SUVs out of Alabama and South Carolina. Yeah. They are hit with a 25% tariff. So I'm with him. We should just say, China, we're going to adapt your same tariff. And I hadn't even thought about maybe forcing any Chinese company that wants to come here to say, you got to manufacture and you got to find a joint venture partner.
Well, the question is, is the idea that you would force China to open up plants in the U.S.?
Well, at the very least, you would first say, and GM with the Envision and Volvo with the S60 long wheelbase and soon to be the S90 would have to pay a 25% import tariff. That would put the end to them importing cars.
But the voluntary tariffs or the voluntary restrictions on Japanese is basically what got them to build plants in the U.S.
Right.
But that never applied to South Korea. Is that correct? I don't think it did.
No, it was only to Japan.
Here's the interesting thing. Now, this is the big difference, of course, is going to be the cost, the wages in China. As long as it's an ostensibly communist country, it'll be a lot cheaper to hire people to work there. But I wondered at first why Hyundai was looking to build a plant here when, at the time, this is how many years ago, 15, 20 years ago, South Korea had such lower wages and Hyundai was on the upswing. It was selling cars here. The quality perception was going up. And, why would you want to build them here instead of import them if you had that? Now you've got basically parity. It costs as much with shipping and so on to bring a car over from South Korea. So, yes, build them here.
Yeah.
So is there a potential to get to that point with the Chinese? I don't know.
Well, look, the whole argument before was, look, we, the United States, were in favor of free trade. So we're not going to adopt these prohibitive tariffs. We'll just live with it. Well, guess what? Trump's president, that argument's out the window right now. And I think it's very likely, in fact, I would almost bet money on it, that we're going to turn around and say, hey, China, we're just adopting your standards.
Would we have to do Japan then, too?
Look, Honda makes more cars in the United States than it makes in Japan. You know, that's how much.
But you can't.
And it would, but it wouldn't pay off because the Japanese market isn't that big.
No, it's not.
Right. Yeah, but Toyota makes more cars in Japan than it makes in the United States.
But China, that's why.
Even though the U.S.
countries.
Is Toyota's biggest market.
Yeah.
So if you're saying you're trying to adapt the same tariff that they impose on us when we send something over to Japan, we've tried that.
But
GM tried to sell.
Japan was far more sophisticated about it. It wasn't so much the tariff, which was negligible. It was how you had to meet their standards. So it was almost as if every car had to be individually inspected by a human being in a warehouse on Tuesday afternoon at 4. I mean, they just slowed everything.
John, I got a better idea. Let's get Tyson and what are the other chicken companies to start dumping really cheap chicken into China.
I was just going to bring that up and ask if we think this will be the end of the chicken tax.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen because that's the whole thing. This is why the auto industry in America was worried about TTIP, the Trans-Pacific, or not TTIP, TTP. TTIP is the European one. There's all these crazy trade agreements. But anyway, look, what makes GM, Ford, and FCA as profitable as they are is the chicken tax. You take that away and holy moly. You know, because we charge a 25% tariff for any truck that comes into this country.
It killed the midsize truck segment. I mean, that's one of the things that everybody.
Well, for a while.
To. Yeah.
Well, it's also costing Ford and FCA to bring in vans as window vans and then replace the windows with. They're still making money on them, of course. Right. But they have to weld back the panel.
But it also keeps players like Mahindra out of the market.
Yeah.
That might come in with a cheaper alternative.
They do want to come in still, and they're still working on that.
You could argue that, but look at, so you've got Toyota and Nissan building pickup trucks here, and Toyota does well with the Tacoma, but, even building the Titan and the Tundra here, they've barely been able to scratch the surface of what Ford and GM and...
Well, with Tacoma, Toyota dominates the midsize market.
Well, they do.
I want to say the Tacoma sells more than Colorado and Canyon put together.
But that number is still in the 150,000 range?
They had 50% of the market before the 75% when they...
I think the number's higher than that. I wish I could remember off the top of my head.
It's under 2.
It's under 2, yes.
Yeah. For Tacoma?
Yeah. I looked it up because I just did a program in Hawaii with them on the TRD Pro. Yep. And
it's the number one selling vehicle in Hawaii, Tacoma.
Yes.
Not just trucks.
Anything.
Anything.
Anything, yes.
And they are everywhere.
Yep.
There's a taco truck on every corner.
Let me ask this, because we're talking about all of this and trade, and does the American public who voted for Trump care where their vehicle came from? Outside of the blue-collar Americans and workers in Detroit and the factories, does anyone know?
They don't know. I think they want it to be from America, made by American workers, but they have no clue. They don't even know what engines are.
Do you think anyone in California cares about the U.S. Rust Belt and manufacturing?
They didn't vote for Trump. That was the predication of your question.
Very true.
But they care if their electric car is made in Fremont. That's the big thing in California. It's a different market. But I think there is still parts of the country where, the Buy American kind of prevails, mostly around here.
Yeah, but even that, I've seen the Buy American stickers on cars that weren't made in America.
Right.
They're made in Canada or they're made in Mexico. They just have the American emblem on it, of an automaker. And I guarantee you 9 out of every 10 Buick Envision owners have no idea where that car was made.
Look at the Buick Encore.
Yeah,
that's coming out of Korea.
But look, this all comes down to wages, right? This all comes down to what kind of blue-collar base you have. The factory jobs have been going away in this country since at least the 1980s, but the president-elect has made a big issue out of that and got the voter who, may have been working in a factory 20 or 30 years ago and is working at Walmart now and I think that's really what it comes down to.
Hey, look, we got more questions from the audience. We got more questions from you guys, too, I'm sure. But we got to take another quick break here and give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking about all kinds of things with the automotive industry, but especially about this election. It keeps coming up. It was a big one.
Yeah.
Okay, we got another phoner here. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
This is Clem Zurofsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. Even if Mr. Trump does not get anything else done in his career as president, he will have a big effect on the Supreme Court, which is very, very important even for the automobile industry, because they alone can overrule any rules that were made that may be detrimental to the automotive industry. Is there, they could take the case to the Supreme Court if they think the rule was made by government that was detrimental to the automobile industry. Thank you.
So is he saying that someone would file a suit against California to bring that in the Supreme Court? I'm not quite sure what he's doing with that.
Well, I think his point is that Trump's going to be making some Supreme Court appointments, and that could change the nature
of the court.
At least one that we know of, right. So
filibustering there, I think.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. Okay, enough of the election already. There's lots of other good stuff to talk about here. What do you guys make of L.A. Auto Show right around the corner? Anything shaking coming out of that?
I'm looking forward to the Alfa Romeo SUV.
The Stelvio?
Yeah. Yes, the Stelvio, which they haven't confirmed, but everyone's still calling it that. And I think Marchione actually said it over in Europe. That's my number one thing that I want to see, because Alfa Romeo, it's been a long time coming since they announced their return, and they're just returning after the 4C, and now they've got the Giulia, which they're actually on the ground with. And the SUV, I think, is going to be their most important product they actually launch over there through 2020, even though they backed up their plan to 2025. They need that to do well. And the reviews right now on the Giulia have been extremely
positive.
Good. Yeah, positive.
Right. Chris, anything you're looking for in L.A.?
You know, I feel like auto shows, unfortunately, are getting less and less important in the, you know, in the unveils that we're seeing. That we were just talking about this in the green room
prior to the show
that, you know, a lot of more things are happening outside of
off-site,
right?
Not at the show itself,
right?
But
built
around the show.
Well, yes, or completely separately. We're seeing more and more of both. Both can be more economical because you don't have to pay for the display space and for all of the, you know, the hoo-ha that goes into producing an unveil. And also, you can pick the timing and control the news cycle. That can be the unveil of the day. That can be the important thing. As far as important products go, I'm very curious because I think Alfa Romeo styling is gorgeous, so I'm curious to see how that applies to an SUV. Beyond that, I've always had a soft spot for the Mercedes E63 AMG. There's a new one of those coming out. And there's some odds and ends. There are some special editions and things here and there, but I don't know that there's that one capstone product, that one event vehicle that we're seeing coming out of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, LA's hard for me to get a handle on a little bit because for many years I just didn't go to the LA show, and for many years it was a week before Detroit. And so you have this kind of hierarchy where Detroit's still by far the big show where all the important product comes out, and then I'd put New York number two, and LA is trying to get ahead of Chicago, which is a great public show, but usually has a new trim level or a new paint color for a pickup truck or something, and get up to New York level. And I think they're still struggling with that. There's an Audi reveal on Tuesday night. Yeah, the things that happen offsite, a lot of them happen surrounding the auto show, and then it's all made so that by the time the car shows to the public on the stand, we have our stories out. Alpha, interesting thing. You know, how long can they go with just a couple of products in U.S. showrooms? They just got the Giulia and the 4C. Now they'll be adding the Stelvio. Further development's been choked off, as you point out, put out 5 years behind, and was also supposed to spawn a new Dodge Challenger and Dodge Charger. So hard to say where all that stuff is right now.
Well, to get back to the automakers actually at the auto shows, no matter what they're going to have put up the stages, they're going to put up the displays, because at the end of the day, the auto show is meant to sell cars to the public. We look at it from the media days where they have all the glitz and glamour, the reveals, a snowstorm here and there inside of a conference room or driving through glass. But at the end of the day, the dealers are the ones hosting these auto shows. They're the ones that are trying to sell the vehicles in their areas. And that's why Chicago is so successful with their population, right? Because it's a huge consumer show.
The biggest.
But the automakers themselves, I mean, look at GM. Look at how many vehicles they've unveiled at non-auto show events, and including CES. CES has taken a lot away from the auto shows. It's why LA Mobility now is now called the press days for LA, along with that press or the conference. And Detroit has a new mobility conference too.
Automobility.
And everyone's trying to adapt to stay relevant. And I think it's New York seems to be doing fairly well for itself.
Yeah.
It's not a big consumer show at all, but it's a high-end luxury market that the automakers want to unveil their products at.
In part because New York gets a lot of non-automotive media there, major media, all the outlets. And then you look at what's happening in Europe. I mean, for years, BMW and Mercedes and Volkswagen and some of the other brands have put out a release 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time saying, here's our new whatever, with full photos and so on. Comes off embargo before you get to the show. You go to the show, you get to look at it, and they hope you'll do a second story. And we try to do at automobilemag.com, we try to do a little bit of a wrap-up and say, here's what we saw in the tin, and here's what we liked, here's what we didn't like, here's what kind of confounds us. And so that's kind of the way to cover it now.
But it's getting harder and harder as for us in the media, because I'm going to L.A. next week. Okay, I'm going on a Chevy program, but then first night I got to jump over and do some stuff with Ford, and then I got to come back and do some stuff with Chevy. All the while, this Automobility LA is taking place. Then I got to go to, you know, the Staples Center where the actual show is taking place and see what's going on there. It used to be you could go to the show center and you'd see everything. Now everybody, all the automakers, want to do their own event separate, off-site. And so I'm running all over L.A. to try to keep up with this stuff.
Well, the key word is running all over L.A. That's so spread out, whereas Chicago or New York and especially Detroit, it's pretty concentrated in a fairly...
It is, but I think you're going to see more and more this happening at more and more auto shows, where automakers want to control the news cycle. Mm-hmm. They want to have everybody captive and not running 20 minutes later off to the next unveil.
Well, and there are some smaller players that are not even showing it, you know, at the Staples Center. I think Lamborghini has an off-site event, but they're not going to be showing actually there unless there's some sort of dealer presence. There's no company presence. And I think what you're seeing is more and more people trying to find different ways to get people to their events, to their media, to cover their unveil. And they're finding that, you know, some of their reveals will get kind of lost in the cycle with all the other vehicles that are out there. But again, they can control the message. They can get people, you know, even if they have to fly in journalists to that reveal. We had the CRV here in town not long ago at Eastern Market. That's a huge product in the biggest segment. That is the new Accord, if you will. And it was unveiled at a farmer's market. I mean, it's...
in Detroit, which was the most interesting thing I thought about that. It was Honda bringing to Detroit for that reveal, and like it was nothing to do with an auto show. And they wanted to control its cycle, but it's also, we're in good times. Automakers are profitable. They can afford to have a lot of these off-site events. They can afford to fly in as many media as they'd like and have these events where auto show is pretty much standard. You pay a set price and you go from there.
Yeah, although I've heard it's cheaper to do it. Because of the union costs associated with putting up a lot of these.
Here's the biggest factor, I think. I think you're seeing, especially probably since the Great Recession, since the bankruptcies and so on. I haven't counted them up, but you don't have the number of concepts that you used to have. So that's what distinguishes, say, a Detroit auto show from showing the production version of the Honda CRV offsite a couple months before the show. You'd go to an auto show to see a concept that couldn't be moved anyway, and you'd go to see a bunch of them in the same area, and you'd get an idea of, well, in a year or two, I'm going to see the production version of that concept, maybe, and that's what made the auto show special. That's what got all the attention in the old days.
I miss true concepts, because, I mean, Ford's been notorious in years to say, concept.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's the exact same vehicle that's been approved.
Oh, yeah. They just take the door handles off and lower the vehicle.
However, they did surprise me with the Lincoln Navigator concept with the gull-wing doors and that retro interior.
Right.
Those are fun things. But you also have SEMA now, along with CES, where the automakers kind of...
You have Pebble
and
Beach.
Moab, and Pebble Beach.
Yeah.
To kind of do a lot of these luxurious and big concepts.
Yeah.
And then they'll show them to media. But I think the regular consumers going to the auto show is seeing more and more that it's pretty much just the regular cars, like you said, Todd, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of sad.
I totally agree. I think you got to sell the public the dream.
Well,
you know, that's how you make them want a car. Then you sell them what you got on the show floor.
Well, and I think there's some country-to-country differences, too, because if you go to the European shows, the French automakers are tiny, right? They don't have, but they still put out pretty pie in the sky concept cars every year.
You can't keep up with all the Peugeots and Citroëns done at Geneva and Paris
and Peugeot. I love their concept
cars.
I think they do some of the best stuff going.
Right, and they're not those incremental, like here's the next version of X, or subtract wheel size, add mirror size, and here's your production vehicle in 2 years. They are future think. Jetsons way out there, still sort of propositions. And that's, one of the things that got me as an enthusiast into this business. I loved the future think, and everybody's just been reined in so much, whether it was, cost constraints or what have you. But I like to see people still, shooting for the moon.
Well, the decline of the Tokyo show, huge for concepts.
Yeah. Well, one of the biggest things, too, is that the automakers aren't spending as much time changing the sheet metal, but the actual electronics and things that we don't necessarily see immediately, so it's not as elaborate as you would typically think. Like, I'm guaranteeing in L.A., there are going to be a lot of vehicles or automakers, including Hyundai, which we were just talking about technology, talking about autonomous vehicles, talking about what their vehicle can do on the road and the interior and what these future technologies are going to hold, not necessarily how they redesigned the wheel or the front fascia.
Yeah. Well, it's changing for sure. I think it's going to change a lot. I think people are getting their information in different ways. And while for the public, I think auto shows will be around for a long time to come, for the media, it's definitely changing, as we were just talking about.
But we're still going to
We're still going to go, you bet. Well, all four of us will be in L.A. next week. But look, time to wrap up the show. So I want to thank all of you for coming along. Todd Lassa, Automobile Magazine, always great to have you here. Chris Pockert, Roadshow by CNET. Good having you here, too. And Mike Whalen with the Detroit News.
Always fun.
Good. Want to thank all of you, especially, for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.